completely down to I-5, and I-5 itself blocked. So I-5 is not really an alternative until you're well past Fresno to the south. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support comes from visitors' coverage. Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers, announcing the Kia Summer Event now through July 8th, offering a selection of Kia EVs, SUVs, and sedans. More info at kia.com, Kia, movement that inspires. Coming up on KQED News at 9:04, we'll have a live update from the Corral Fire, so please stay tuned for that. And then join us later today for the Sunday Music Drop from San Francisco dance music producer Chrissy. That's coming up this afternoon at 5:35. This is KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highlands Sacramento. It's 9 o'clock.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. The guilty verdicts are in for former President Trump in his first criminal trial. We'll tell you what it could mean for the election in November. And a new study found that girls are getting their periods earlier on average. Find out more. Plus, the new animated film, Robot Dreams, deals with some weighty emotions like longing, loss, and accepting change. Definitely not just for kids.
One of the amazing things about Robot is that he uses dreams to overcome his loneliness. To dream, it really helps to feel not lonely.
And more. It's Sunday, June 2nd. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. It's Election Day in Mexico, and this is an historic election. NPR's Ada Peralta reports more than 20,000 positions are up for grabs, including the presidency.
The polls have just opened here in Tepoztlán, just outside Mexico City. This station was a bit late to open, but voters are filing in, and so far, everything is running smoothly. More than 90 million Mexicans are registered to vote, and they will be picking a wide range of public servants, from mayors to senators to the next president of Mexico. The two leading presidential candidates are women, and that means that more than likely Mexico will have a woman president for the first time since it became a republic more than 200 years ago. This election season, however, has been marred by violence. More than 30 candidates have been assassinated, and more than 200 polling stations across the country will not open at all because of violence or the threat of violence. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Tepoztlán.
Iceland held a presidential election yesterday. The three top candidates were women. The National Broadcasting Service reports today that the winner is Halla Thomas' daughter, a businesswoman and investor. She was elected to the largely ceremonial post with 34% of the vote. In the U.S., political analysts are trying to determine what effect the conviction of former President Donald Trump will have on November's presidential election. The presumptive Republican nominee was found guilty of 34 felonies. Polls conducted since then may provide some clues. NPR's Mara Liasson has more.
We do have some polling since the verdict. According to the new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll, 2/3 of voters said the guilty verdict wouldn't affect their vote at all, but roughly 17% said it would make them less likely to vote for Trump. In a tight election, little changes make a big difference. We have a poll from Reuters, Ipsos. 25% of independent voters said the guilty verdict would make them less likely to vote for Trump. 1 in 10 Republicans in that poll said they were now less likely to vote for Trump, too. And we have a Morning Consult poll that shows 49% of independent voters thought Trump should end his campaign.
NPR's Mara Liasson reporting. Wall Street is gearing up for an important report on employment this week. Markets would like to see a little cooling in hiring. NPR's Rafael Nam reports.
The strong labor market has been one of the highlights of the U.S. economy. Having more people employed is obviously a good thing. But there are concerns that all this hiring is contributing to more inflation. For investors and for policymakers at the Federal Reserve, the ideal scenario would be a labor market that still growing solidly, but without heating up the economy too much. So there's a lot of anticipation ahead of the latest monthly report on employment. It's out on Friday. Rafael Nam, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. Wildfire season has begun. The Corral Fire started yesterday south of Tracy and has grown to over 12,000 acres since it started. KQED reporter Catherine Monahan is on the scene with the latest. Catherine, what does it look like where you are?
I can see a big plume of smoke, and it's drifting southeast. There's blackened hills in front of me, and then the rest of the grass is that yellow-brown color that we see this time of year. So ready to go up.
What is the weather like?
It's getting hot. It's heading towards 70 right now, around 9 o'clock, and forecast to get up to 85 this afternoon, with winds gusting up to 26 miles an hour, according to NOAA. I saw a lot of high wind signs on the way out here.
And what's the latest on road closures in the area?
580 is closed between Corral Hollow Road and Interstate 5 in both directions.
Okay, thank you so much. We're seeing the latest news is that it is 15% contained. That's up a little bit from about an hour ago. We'll continue to bring you more updates throughout the day from Catherine and others. Thank you so much, Catherine Monahan. I'm Natalia Navarro, and this is KQED News.
Support for NPR comes from Disney Plus with the new Disney Plus original documentary, Jim Henson, Idea Man. Filmmaker Ron Howard captures Henson's artistic evolution in the style and spirit of his complex subject, now streaming on Disney Plus. And the listeners of KQED. Well, as you just heard from Natalia and Catherine, wildfire season is here in California. KQED.org has facts about what to do if you need to evacuate in a wildfire situation and how to prepare before it happens. You can find that on our website at KQED.org, and you can find updated evacuation details for the Corral Fire at sjready.org. Stay with us for Weekend Edition continuing until 10 o'clock. Then we've got Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, all here on KQED Public Radio.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning, and thank you for joining us today. 34 felony counts, and a jury unanimously found former President Donald Trump guilty of all of them. He had a lot to say about it and spoke for over 30 minutes on Friday.
This is a scam. This is a rigged trial. It shouldn't have been in that venue. We shouldn't have had that judge.
Responding to the verdict, President Biden said that Donald Trump was treated just like every other citizen and that he has the right to an appeal. He also defended the justice system.
Our justice system has endured for nearly 250 years, and it literally is the cornerstone of America, our justice system. The justice system should be respected, and we should never allow anyone to tear it down.
We're joined now by NPR's senior national political correspondent, Mara Liasson. Good morning, Mara.
Good morning, Aisha.
Okay, we have just about 5 months between now and the elections in November. Oh, my goodness. But right now, it seems all everyone is talking about is this verdict and what it means. Is that a loss for Trump and a win for Democrats?
Certainly wasn't a good day for Donald Trump. Who wins the politics of this is still unclear, but the loser is certainly United States democracy. Trump has stressed the system to the breaking point. If you don't prosecute him for this case or for mishandling classified documents or trying to overturn the 2020 election, well, then he's above the law. If you do prosecute him, he'll try to destroy Americans' faith in the justice system. We do know that there are now three litmus tests for Republicans in the Trump-led GOP. The first one is the 2020 election was rigged. They don't accept that result. Second one is they won't accept the 2024 election results unless Trump wins. And the rule of law does not apply to Donald Trump. In other words, any judgment against him is illegitimate. And although we can assume with some certainty that if he was acquitted or if there was a hung jury, he certainly would have said that the rule of law prevailed.
So back in 2016, then candidate Trump said that he could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and he wouldn't lose any voters. You think that's still true?
Well, that may be true over time, but according to a jury of his peers, he can't get away with a far lesser crime. And what we don't know yet is whether this verdict will make it easier for the Biden campaign to make this a choice election, not a referendum on the incumbent, which is what it's been so far. You know, Biden always says, compare me to the alternative, not to the almighty. And for voters who see their choice as being someone they think is too old versus someone they think is too dangerous, this might make it easier for the Biden campaign to make that dangerous choice a little more scary.
Okay, but what about the voters here who are trying to figure out what to make of this kind of unprecedented situation we find ourselves in?
Well, one thing that both campaigns agree on, they've both said that whether or not Donald Trump is going to be the next president or not is up to the voters, not juries and judges. We do have some polling since the verdict. According to the new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll, 2/3 of voters said the guilty verdict wouldn't affect their vote at all, but roughly 17% said it would make them less likely to vote for Trump. In a tight election, little changes make a big difference. We have a poll from Reuters, Ipsos. 25% of independent voters said the guilty verdict would make them less likely to vote for Trump. 1 in 10 Republicans in that poll said they were now less likely to vote for Trump, too. And we have a Morning Consult poll that shows 49% of independent voters thought Trump should end his campaign. So I think we have to pay attention to two different kinds of voters. One, moderate Republicans. They've had qualms about Donald Trump. Pay attention to the next bunch of Republican primaries in states like Montana and New Jersey. How many people still vote for Nikki Haley, even though she's not on the ballot? Does she get more than the 20% she's been getting? That would be a sign of continued Republican resistance to Trump. And also pay attention to those young, tuned-out voters, non-white voters who have soured on Joe Biden. Does this conviction finally penetrate? Do they start paying attention? And maybe the Biden campaign hopes, do they remember all the things that they didn't like about Donald Trump?
That's NPR's senior national political correspondent, Mara Liasson. Thank you, Mara.
You're welcome.
And now we turn to Mexico, which is holding its elections today. More than 90 million potential voters will elect leaders to fill some 20,000 positions, from senators and representatives to mayors and council members. They'll also choose a new president, more than likely the country's first woman to be president. NPR's Ada Peralta joins us from Mexico City. Good morning, Ada.
Hey, good morning, Aisha.
So as we've been reporting on this program, these elections are happening amid serious violence. Over 30 candidates have been assassinated this season alone. What's the expectation today?
I mean, we're already seeing some turmoil here. The Electoral Commission says that more than 200 polling stations will not open at all, mostly because of violence or the threat of violence. And this is an election that is happening in a country where different factions of organized crime are in an open war against each other, and politics has gotten pulled into that. It feels like every week we have a new assassination. The latest happened just on Friday. A candidate for the Green Party in the state of Puebla was gunned down in his car. And just before that, on Wednesday, a mayoral candidate in the state of Guerrero was gunned down at his closing rally. And the hope today is that voting goes smoothly, but analysts I've spoken to say don't underestimate the violence that came before the vote, because it has already affected the integrity of these elections.
And now to the issues. What's at stake?
So in Mexico, we have a very popular incumbent president and his party, Morena. They have instituted new welfare programs and they have doubled the minimum wage in the country. These are hugely popular policies. So the ruling party, Morena, is expected to do well. But the thing to watch is not just whether Morena takes the presidency, but whether they are able to get a supermajority in Congress. And that's important because they have campaigned on a series of constitutional amendments, and that includes making both the members of the Supreme Court and the Electoral Commission popularly elected and letting the military control the civilian police. The ruling party says it needs these changes to enact popular policies. The opposition in this country says those changes will lead to democratic backsliding. So the presidency is important, but the only surefire way the ruling party can make the huge changes that it wants to make is by getting that super majority. So we will be watching the margins in Congress. That's something to watch.
So Mexico is poised to elect its first woman president. Tell us about that.
So there are three presidential candidates, but the polls put two women way ahead. Xochitl Galvez, the opposition candidate, and Claudia Sheinbaum, who is the protege of the current president. I've been talking to a lot of women about this, and it feels bittersweet. This tallest of glass ceilings is about to be shattered, but at the same time, the reality for women here in Mexico is harsh. I spoke to Graciela Roque, who runs the feminist website La Cadera de Eva, and she said, yes, we're about to have a woman president, but she wonders, does that mean if women will be able to walk safely on the streets? Will they have equal labor rights? Look, this is a country with one of the highest murder rates against women. And Graciela Roque says, at the moment, all this feels like a fantasy.
Reality is too hard to allow us to really lean into the fantasy. We want to believe and we want to have hope, but then we also don't want to go with it and then just be heartbroken by it.
You know, at the end of the interview, I asked her if she might let herself be taken in by the fantasy as we get results later today. And she said that she sure hopes so.
That's NPR's Ada Peralta reporting from Mexico City. Ada, thank you so much.
Thank you, Aisha.
Aid workers are describing horrific images as the Israeli military intensifies its deadly operation in southern Gaza. President Biden on Friday laid out a plan to end the war, but Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu said his conditions for a ceasefire remained unchanged to destroy Hamas and release the remaining hostages. NPR's Hadil Alshouchi has this report.
Dorothea Gachardo is standing on the roof of her guest house in the El Muasi neighborhood of Rafah, looking at the Mediterranean Sea.
Today, like nearly every day in Gaza, it's warm, it's sunny, and there's a clear blue sky.
Gachardo is with the Canadian NGO GLIA, whose medical teams support field hospitals in Rafah. She shifts her gaze to the left, and that's where that blue Gaza sky turns gray and ominous.
I'm standing here, watching. The neighborhood that my team has been working in every single day since February, burn.
The Gaza Health Ministry and international aid groups say an Israeli strike in El Muasi killed over 20 Palestinians on Tuesday. The area was designated a humanitarian zone. Israel's military denied the strike, but Gachardo says her team saw firsthand the devastation that night.
The primary healthcare center that my team had been working in was converted into a morgue in order to accommodate the bodies.
The El Muasi attack came after another Israeli airstrike on an encampment for displaced Palestinians on Sunday. Prime Minister Netanyahu called that one a tragic mistake. It killed over 40 Palestinians.
It almost defies comprehension to be able to speak about more than one massacre.
James Smith is a British emergency doctor who's been working in Rafah for the past couple of months.
Is it the flour massacre? Is it the bakery massacre? Now it's the IDP camp. Massacre.
The attacks came days after the United Nations top court ordered Israel to immediately halt its operation in Rafah. But as of now, Palestinians in Gaza still say nowhere is safe. Hadil Alshouchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
You're listening to NPR News.
And you're listening to KQED Public Radio. Support for KQED comes from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, committed to brewing things the right way since 1980. Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, still family-owned, operated, and argued over. And PG&E, if customers see a downed power line, stay away from it and keep others away. Call 911. Let first responders come out and handle it. Police and fire will respond, as well as PG&E. PGE.com/safety. We go now to Mel Baker, who continues his reporting on the Corral Fire.
Yeah, so we're looking, as you head through the Altamont Pass, eastbound into the Central Valley, 580 at the 205 merge is closed. You can't take that south toward I-5, which is also closed. 205 westbound remains open, though. On the Bay Bridge right now, some unusual traffic, 80 eastbound between the Center Anchorage and Yerba Buena Tunnel, stop and go. I'm not sure what's causing that. It's also causing it in the westbound direction as you come toward Treasure Island. Mel Baker for KQED.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Singapore today. They discussed a potential security agreement as Russia makes gains in Ukraine's northeast. Mexicans are voting today to elect a new president, both houses of Congress and local officials. The election has been marred by violence. Officials say at least 37 candidates have been murdered while campaigning. And security is heightened in New York City today for the annual Parade for Israel. Organizers say this year the focus will be on solidarity, strength, and resilience because of the war in Gaza and Hamas still holding hostages. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And Sattva, offering 9 different types of handcrafted mattresses, including delivery, setup, and old mattress removal. More at SAATVA.com. And the listeners of KQED.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Girls in the U.S. are getting their first period earlier on average than they did in the 1950s and 60s. That's according to a large new study published this past week in the journal JAMA Network Open. That's a journal of the American Medical Association. And it's taking longer for menstrual cycles to become regular. Here to tell us more about what it all means is NPR health correspondent Maria Godoy. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
When we talk about early menstruation, how much earlier are we talking about?
On average, it's about 6 months earlier. So the average age used to be 12 and a half years old, and now it's just under 12. And that may not sound like very much, but the number of girls getting their periods early or very early, so I'm talking about girls under 11 or even under age 9, that's roughly doubled. And while this trend is happening across demographic groups, it's more pronounced in girls of color and those from lower incomes. I spoke with Dr. Shruthi Mahalingaya of Harvard. She's the study's co-author. And she notes that these trends have big mental and emotional health implications.
You know, the younger you are when you get your first period, it's very confusing. There's still a lot of stigma and silence around it. It's important to educate caregivers, parents, and care providers on this trend so that we can also prepare our children.
And, you know, just as importantly, earlier menstruation also has long-term implications for physical health.
So what kind of long-term health issues might these girls face?
Well, getting your first period at an earlier age has been linked to health problems like higher risk of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and even early death. It's also linked to a higher risk of several cancers, especially breast cancer. Here's Lauren Houghton. She's an epidemiologist at Columbia University whose research focuses on women's health.
If someone reaches their first period before the age of 12, they're at a 20% increased risk for breast cancer.
And this trend toward early puberty and menstruation has been going on for decades, and it's happening around the world. And given that these changes in the timing of menstruation can affect health outcomes later in life, researchers say it's important to be aware of them. Houghton says we should think of menstruation as a vital sign for health.
So do we know why this is happening?
Well, all the researchers I spoke with say it's not just one thing, it's multiple factors. So, for example, obesity is known to be a risk factor for earlier menstruation in and of itself, but stress is also a known risk factor. And Houghton says when you're stressed, your body produces more cortisol and more androgens, and these are hormones that fat tissues can then convert into estrogen.
And it's estrogen which signals the body to grow breasts. And then it's cyclical estrogen, so changes in estrogen, that signals the body to actually start their menstrual cycles.
And there's actually another really important factor here. Our environment is swimming in chemicals known to disrupt our endocrine system. For example, things like phthalates, which are found in plastics and in a ton of personal care products and cosmetics. And some air pollutants are endocrine disruptors too.
Oh, wow. I mean, so what can a parent do?
I have a young daughter, and this is top of my mind. One thing is that the advice for healthy living in general can help with earlier puberty too. So eating a healthy diet with plenty of fruits and vegetables and getting daily exercise can help mitigate some of those risk factors for earlier puberty and menstruation, and can also help reduce the risk of the associated health outcomes down the road if your child does get their period early. Getting enough sleep is tough, but it's also really important. Some studies have linked later bedtimes and shorter sleep duration to early puberty. And of course, if you're the parent of a child who is approaching puberty, talk to them about what they can expect and realize that their first period might happen earlier than you might have thought.
That's NPR health correspondent Maria Godoy. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Bookstores in Ukraine are expanding despite the war, fueled by soaring interest in works by Ukrainian writers, some of whom have been killed by Russian forces. A deadly Russian strike on a major book printing plant late last month is reigniting calls to protect Ukrainian heritage. NPR's Joanna Kakissis has more from the city of Kharkiv.
After the missile strike, the Faktor Druk printing factory looked like a crime scene. In the sprawling warehouse, firefighters hosed down piles of burning books. There was blood on the wall. Seven people died here.
The roof has caved in. I'm standing next to several stacks of books, the remnants of books. These are novels. These are textbooks. These are children's books.
Most came from Vivat, one of Ukraine's largest publishers. Artem Litvinets is the editor-in-chief.
We lost at least 50,000 books. It was painful to hear from the writers who talked about how hard they had worked on these books and how the Russians destroyed them.
Vivat has its headquarters in Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city. 80% of books in Ukraine are printed in Kharkiv, even under constant Russian bombardment. The Russian border is about 20 miles away.
People who decide to stay in Kharkiv are making a statement, one that says, the city is alive as long as we are here.
We meet Litvinets at one of Vivat's bookstores in Kharkiv. It's colorful and tidy. The shelves are full.
Since the beginning of the full-scale war, Vivat has doubled in size in terms of staff and the number of books in stock. Also, we started out with three bookstores, including this one in Kharkiv, and now we have nine.
Mysteries and romantic fiction are popular. Litvinets calls it escapism and a brutal reality. Ukrainian authors are especially in demand.
We don't sell anything in Russian. People switched entirely to Ukrainian. Pulp fiction, fantasy, history, literally everything.
Before 2022, Kharkiv used to be a Russian-speaking city. Today, it has a popular poetry slam entirely in Ukrainian. One of the founders is Artem Elf. He says, we have our own culture, our own artists who are not connected to Russia, who have a completely different space. 18-year-old Yulia Lipneva recites a heartfelt poem about Kharkiv, her hometown, as it fights for its life in this war. She says young Ukrainian writers like herself are trying to fill the gap left by those killed in the war. They include poets and novelists who have defined Ukrainian identity today. The losses are often compared to the executed Renaissance, a literary generation murdered by the Soviets almost a century ago. The downtown apartment building where some of the executed Renaissance writers lived still stands. A man walking by tells us, we didn't even know their names when we were in school during Soviet times, because we mainly heard about the Russians. The writers' stories are told at Kharkiv's Literary Museum. Director Tatiana Pilipchuk shows us around. She says Ukrainians, especially in Kharkiv, need metaphors in a shared language to make sense of their wartime experiences.
The question of identity used to be a matter of choice here. My family were Ukrainians who chose Russian culture. Later, I decided to choose Ukrainian culture. Now this choice is a question of life and death.
The Factor Druk printing plant has gone quiet since the missile attack. Owner Sergei Politucci says he plans to restore and reopen it. We meet him at his book-filled office in central Kharkiv, a city he says he won't leave.
Kharkiv is the capital of publishing and capital of printing. Inside myself, in my soul, in my heart, I feel a responsibility.
Some of the books destroyed in the missile attack were displayed at a major literary festival in the capital, Kyiv, this weekend. The title was simple, Books Destroyed by Russia. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kharkiv.
Listening to music was radically different in 1999. There was no streaming back then, so you were expected to buy the albums you wanted. August Brown covers the music industry for the Los Angeles Times. He remembers what it took to listen to a song outside radio stations or on music TV channels like MTV. You needed to buy compact discs or cassettes.
You were pretty bound by the physical format. You know, people obviously did rip music off of CDs and put them onto your computer that you could make custom mixes for an aspirant loved one. But on the whole, there was a really tight connection between a physical object and the way that you experienced music in the world.
But all that changed 25 years ago on June 1st, 1999 with the launch of Napster, an online platform that let fans upload songs and share them for free. In other words, peer-to-peer file sharing. And it signaled a sea change in how we consume music, first becoming popular with college students.
The advent of high-speed internet on college campuses, which kind of enable much faster connections than most people had ever experienced on, you know, dial-up AOL at their homes. And it enabled people to post their music catalogs of MP3s and allow pretty much anyone else that was using Napster to have access to them.
With unlimited access to free music, Napster's impact was immediate.
Within a matter of weeks and months, it instantly became, you know, the greatest change in the music industry, arguably, since the vinyl record.
Brown says Napster also saved fans from needing to buy a full album when they only liked a couple of songs.
The idea that you could unbundle individual songs from an album had obviously been around since the beginning of the record industry, but now fans could do that and they could do it without paying a dime for anything.
Some smaller bands appreciated the exposure they got on Napster. But for bigger artists, Napster spelled lost revenue on album sales, and they fought back. Metallica drummer Lars Ulrich testified before Congress in 2000, telling lawmakers that Napster had essentially, quote, hijacked their music.
We should decide what happens to our music, not a company with no rights in our recordings, which has never invested a penny in our music or had anything to do with its creation. The choice has been taken away from us.
The band was especially incensed over one of their tracks being available on Napster before it was officially released. Metallica took Napster to court and won. Still, many fans reacted by picking on Ulrich and other artists who criticized Napster, seeing them as defending the interests of big record labels. And while all of that was a quarter of a century ago, the fight between artists and tech companies, which now stream music and make a cut of the profits, is ongoing. But the irony, says Brown, is that public opinion has flipped. Back then, Napster and its subsequent imitators were seen as freeing music for fans who felt nickeled and dimed by record labels with expensive albums. But now,
it's the tech industry that has crushed artists. You know, artists have been told for a generation now that, oh, it's better to give your music away for free for marketing purposes. And now they're realizing that they have gotten, you know, the raw end of that deal and are left with, you know, being paid nothing while these big kind of faceless companies reap all the benefits of advertising on top of that.
Napster did not last long. Legal battles led to its demise just 3 years after its launch, but its impact on the music industry remains. Fans grew accustomed to getting individual songs for cheap. Apple's music store iTunes became wildly successful, selling songs for 99 cents to play on an iPod or your laptop. Today's streaming platforms like Spotify offer a virtually limitless music catalog for a low monthly subscription. But Brown says that Napster's main legacy might be what it taught other tech startups like Uber and Airbnb, that you can disrupt an industry by being ahead of online regulations.
I think the real impact of Napster is not just kind of the advent of streaming, but for the broader tech industry at large. They learned that you can just do something self-beneficial, and if you can scale up fast enough, the industry will have to bend to you before the law can catch up to you.
In other words, the more things change, the more they stay the same. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Towers in New York and Chicago dominate the list of America's tallest buildings. But a proposed skyscraper in Oklahoma City would loom over not only the city's skyline, but also one of the city's oldest and most charming neighborhoods. It would also be the tallest building in the U.S. Grayson Wheeler with member station KOSU checked in with residents about the idea.
I'm standing in a huge, half-empty parking lot in Oklahoma City. These 4 acres of asphalt aren't really a hotbed of activity right now, but in a few years, this could be the site of the tallest building in the United States, the sixth tallest in the world. Shane Cooley teaches yoga nearby. He's still weighing whether the proposed skyscraper is a good idea.
What's the benefit of that? I mean, sure, you can put a restaurant or, you know, some kind of spa in there and bring people in, but you need tenants all the way up, and that's a lot of tenants.
But California developer Scott Madison says the skyscraper is happening, and soon.
We have our financing in place, so that's our goal, is to finish up our construction drawings and start construction in the summer or in the fall.
He says inspiration hit when he first came to the city for a medical visit.
I wouldn't say that the project idea came dragged me to Oklahoma City, but once I got there, I saw the amazing opportunities to do something exciting and new.
But some Oklahoma City residents are skeptical the building will happen. Shannon Burke lives just a few blocks away from the potential skyscraper.
I feel like it's kind of a PR stunt of like, hey, let's just make something really funny and unrealistic and talk about it. But I think people are kind of serious about it.
Oklahoma City's Planning Commission moved the proposal forward in April, although they nixed the electronic displays that would span the entire height of the tower. Here's Commissioner Mike Prevett.
We're not New York or Las Vegas, I don't think, but not yet anyways.
The project is slated for Bricktown, one of Oklahoma City's oldest neighborhoods. Today, it's full of restaurants, bars, and museums that used to be warehouses. Bricktown's buildings, streets, and walkways heavily feature, you guessed it, bricks. The new tower won't blend in. Lead architect Rob Budetti says Madison isn't drawing inspiration from the neighborhood.
He just felt like that wasn't the right vibe, you know what I mean, that he was trying to create, and he was, you know, trying to kind of elevate Oklahoma City.
And what does that elevation look like to California-based developers and architects?
It's definitely more on the modern, you know, a lot of glass.
The glass tower would be 1907 feet high to commemorate the year Oklahoma became a state. It's both an homage and a one-up to the country's current tallest building, One World Trade, which stands at 1776 feet high. Burke doesn't like that the new building would stand twice as tall as any other in the Oklahoma City skyline.
I think it would be a big eyesore, but if it gets people talking and bringing them to Oklahoma to go see this crazy skyscraper, then it could help the economy.
Think roadside novelty. Move over, world's largest ball of twine in Kansas. Here comes America's tallest building.
I kind of see it something like that. It's just something to look at.
The tower still needs a final stamp of approval from the Oklahoma City Council. That vote is expected to take place in June. For NPR News, I'm Grayson Wheeler in Oklahoma City.
This is NPR News.
And this is KQED Public Radio. Support for KQED comes from San Francisco International Airport. SFO travelers can discover global flavors and unique shops, all before takeoff. Learn more about SFO restaurants and shops at flysfo.com. And Front Porch communities in Sonoma County, the East Bay, Silicon Valley, and the Monterey Peninsula. Visit fpretirement.net to learn more. That's fpretirement.net.
On this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Dakota Johnson describes her now famous press junket strategy.
I remember these really uncomfortable moments where I didn't want to answer a question, so I'd say absolutely nothing. And the person thought that I was malfunctioning.
I'm Peter Sagal. You can hear Dakota answer our questions, plus Bob Seger telling us about the crazy rock and roll lifestyle of the 70s. It's all on this week's News Quiz from NPR.
This morning at 10.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. California firefighters are battling a wildfire that's burning about 50 miles east of San Francisco. It's now more than 12,000 acres and has been 15% contained. An interstate connecting the San Francisco Bay Area to Central California has been closed in both directions. Iceland held a presidential election yesterday. The three top candidates were women. The National Broadcasting Service reports today the winner is Halla Thomas' daughter, a businesswoman and investor. And North Korea says it will stop, for now, sending balloons with trash to South Korea. Seoul says hundreds such balloons were sent over the past week. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. For more than 75 years, AU has supported freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more at au.org/NPR. And Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com. And the listeners and sustaining members of KQED.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe, and it's time to play the puzzle. Joining us is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition. Hey there, Will.
Good morning, Aisha.
So, Will, would you please remind us of last week's challenge?
Yes, it came from listener Bob Fetcho of New York City. I said, think of a well-known actor of the past whose last name is also a brand name. Remove the last letter of the actor's first name, and you'll have a product produced by that brand. What is it? Well, the intended answer was Alec Guinness, and if you remove the C from Alec, you get ale, and there Guinness makes ale. There's also an obscure answer some people sent in, Cary Grant. Remove the Y from Cary, and you get car. Back in the 1910s, there was a Grant automobile.
Oh, no, those people went deep into the archives for that one. But there were more than 1,200 correct responses. And this week's winner is Karina Christman of Chicago, Illinois. Congratulations, Karina.
Thank you so much. I am so excited.
Well, I am glad. I am excited for you. How long have you been playing the puzzle?
I've been playing since about 2000, but 5 years ago, I made it my New Year's resolution to win, to actually get to play live, and so it's finally coming true.
Well, that's a lot of dedication. I mean, 5 years, I can't keep my New Year's resolution past, like, February, and you kept it going.
Well, I've lost a lot of other ones, yeah.
Well, you stuck to this one, and it pays off today. Are you ready to play the puzzle?
Yes, I am.
Okay, take it away, Will.
All right, Karina and Aisha, if you were to list the 10 digits from 0 to 9 alphabetically, the first two on the list would be 8 and 5, respectively. In this puzzle, I'm going to name something that's second alphabetically in its category. You tell me what comes first. And your first one is Monday. What's the only day of the week that comes before Monday alphabetically?
Friday.
Friday is it. Good. Jupiter.
Earth?
Earth, it's our own planet. That's right. Alaska.
Alabama?
That's it. Columbus Day.
You said Columbus Day? What comes before Columbus Day? So it's a holiday.
A federal holiday. And it has a connection to your family name.
Christmas,
yes.
I've heard of that, yeah.
Adverb.
Adjective.
That's it. Diamonds.
And, ooh.
We're going for card suits here.
Oh, card suits. Okay. Clubs.
That's
I was thinking of gems.
Right. How about Aries? A-R-I-E-S?
Artemis, no.
So it's like Zodiac?
We're going for signs of the Zodiac.
Okay, what's the
Zodiac, okay.
Okay. There's Aries and then...
What's the other A?
Oh,
Aquarius?
Oh. Yes.
Aquarius, good job. Center fielder.
Center fielder. Before that, there's the catcher.
Good job. Antarctica.
Continent.
Okay.
We're doing continents.
Africa.
Africa, is it? Here's your last one. Doc. D-O-C.
D-O-C. A dock. So like a sheet or a...
We're going for Disney dwarfs here.
Oh.
Oh, okay. So there's sleepy, happy, grumpy.
There's one starting with a B.
Bashful.
Good job.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, I am so glad that you were getting it, the vast majority of these, because I was lost much of the time. So thank goodness that you knew what you were doing. So great job, Karina. How do you feel?
Thank you. I'm on cloud nine. I'm so excited. That was really fun.
You did an excellent job. For playing our puzzle today, you'll get a weekend edition lapel pin as well as puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. And Karina, what member station do you listen to?
WBEZ in Chicago.
That's Karina Christman of Chicago, Illinois. Thank you for playing the puzzle.
Thank you so much, Will and Aisha. Thank you so much.
Okay, Will, what's next week's challenge?
Yes, think of a famous writer with a three-word name. The first two letters of the last name, followed by the first two letters of the middle name, followed by the first two letters of the first name, in order, spell an adjective that describes this author today. Who is it? So again, a famous writer with a three-word name, the first two letters of the writer's last name, followed by the first two letters of the middle name, followed by the first two letters of the first name, in order, spell an adjective that describes this author today. Who is it?
When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle, and click on the Submit Your Answer link. Remember, just one entry, please. Our deadline for entries this week is Thursday, June 6th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Don't forget to include a phone number where we can reach you. If you're the winner, we'll give you a call. And if you pick up the phone, you get to play on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times, but more importantly, the puzzle master of Weekend Edition, Will Shortz. Thank you, Will.
Thanks a lot, Aisha.
Swing, bada, 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 swing. But don't worry about missing the ball if you're playing vintage baseball, which sticks to the rules of the game from 150 years ago. That's when balls were pitched to be hit, not missed. Catchers didn't wear gloves, and umpires really dressed the part. Think vests, bow ties, and top hats that signaled political affiliation.
Back in the 1860s, depending on the height of the hat, was whether you were a Democrat or Republican.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, hear how vintage baseball enthusiasts are keeping its traditions alive. You can listen on air, online, or by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. Sometimes friends have a special song that means something to them and only them. For a dog and robot in the animated film Robot Dreams, it's an Earth, Wind, and Fire song, September.
Do you remember when it first died, September?
The song first appears as the robot and dog are walking through Central Park in New York City, dancing together while on roller skates. They become a star attraction and a huge crowd gathers around them. The film is based on a graphic novel of the same name by Sarah Varon. It follows the story of a lonely dog who buys a build-it-yourself robot to keep him company. The film, Robot Dreams, premiered at Cannes Film Festival last year and has just come out in theaters this weekend. Its director, Pablo Berger, joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Aisha. My pleasure to be talking with you about my baby, Robot Dreams.
Oh, yes. It's a beautiful movie. Now, the graphic novel didn't come with a soundtrack. So why did you choose that Earth, Wind, and Fire song to define the friendship of the dog and the robot?
Yes. When I wrote the script, I wanted them to have roller dancing in Central Park, and I needed a funky disco upbeat song from the, you know, late 70s, early 80s, and straight to my head came September. And it was a very obvious because the story starts in September and the film ends in September of the following year. So we realized, what if it becomes the theme?
And how did you discover the book Robot Dreams, and why did you decide to make a movie about it?
I found it because I collect wordless graphic novels and children's books. And immediately I fell in love with the book, but I just put it on the shelf of my graphic novels because up to now I've been making live action films. And in 2018, I took it out of the shelf. And this time when I read it, when I got to the end of the book, I was so deeply moved. I was in tears. In those 8 years from the first time I read the book to the 2018, my best friend stopped being my best friend. I lost my mother. I thought about relations that I had in the past. And I said, wow, if the book has made this impact on me, if I make a film out of it, I'm really sure that the audience is going to make their own substitutions and think about their loved ones that they're not with them anymore.
So you collect graphic novels and children's books without dialogue. And I know you did a silent film before, a tribute to the silent movie era. And then this one, Robot Dreams, doesn't have dialogue either. Do you have something against dialogue, or is there something that you're getting out of not having the dialogue?
That's right. The visual storytelling, that's what pure cinema is. It is for me. And in a way, I feel like a cinematic terrorist. You know, I like to tell other filmmakers, dialogue can be okay, but we cannot forget what makes cinema a unique way of telling a story is by using images. And that's what I enjoy the most, to tell stories without even one word of dialogue, and that's the case of Robot Dream as well.
You know, usually with film interviews for our show, we play a clip or two of dialogue, but since this is a dialogue-free film, can we watch a scene together and you help narrate it for our listeners? Like, we're going to pick one near the beginning. It's a scene in Central Park, and the dog and robot watch a group of school kids, young animals in the movie, walking down a path holding hands. Like, what happens next?
We see dog and robot walking in Central Park. Dog is like looking at everything, at the trees, at the birds, and suddenly sees a group of school kids with their teachers there, and he sees that two, a little fox and a bear, they're holding hands. And at that moment, he looks at dog and looks at his hand and then grabs the hand. And dog screams because robot is very pushing his hand very hard, and dog, it hurts. But dog knows that robot didn't mean to hurt him. And he says, okay, if robot wants to hold the hand, I'm going to hold the hand. And then they leave the screen like it's a Charlie Chaplin movie, and they're walking away. It's one of my favorite little scenes in the film.
Well, you know, now that you describe it that way, I feel like it gets to a deeper meaning in the movie, which seems to be about intent, like how someone can hurt you, but it's not intentional.
Well, I like your interpretation. And I think life is like that. You know, I think sometimes people hurt us and they really didn't know, or they didn't mean it. And I think forgiveness is one of these great human qualities, and selective memory, how we remember the good things and we forget the bad things. I think it's very important to look forward.
Yeah.
And caress the memories that people that touch us in our lives. This film really made me think a lot about relations and people that I met in the past that they're not with me anymore.
Who do you think was lonelier, the robot or the dog in this movie?
Well, I think how the film starts is, once upon a time in New York City, there was a lonely dog in a railroad apartment in the East Village playing alone a video game. How sad could it be that? And then he just heats up a TV dinner in the microwave, and then he channel surfs, and then he sees some neighbors, a couple, having fun. You know, I was a lonely dog in New York. I lived in New York for a long time. So I think many people can relate. We had moments in our life that we felt that a little bit miserable because we didn't have anybody to share. And robot, I think the robot personality is just like, of course he can be sometimes lonely, but there's something about robot that he's such a positive thinking character. And also, one of the amazing things about robot is that he uses dreams to overcome his loneliness. To dream, it really helps to feel not lonely in his case.
This is a film about two best friends, but there is also a deep message about loss and moving on and longing and letting go. And as an adult, I have a hard time with that letting go stuff. I'm like, no, I'm not giving nothing away, but at the end of the film, I was like, no, go. You don't move on.
Yeah, no, I love how you reacted to the film. You know, no, yes, that's the way. That's the kind of, I made it for you, Aisha, because that's the kind of audience that I like active audience.
Do you think this is for kids or adults, or is that even a question that you thought about?
You know, there's a prejudice still about animation. You know, they think that many, you know, of the audience, even the film critics, they think that it's for kids. And of course, they're animation for kids, but they're animation for adults. This film, as a director, I want the widest possible audience. Film is like a lasagna. It has layers. And I think the pen of, you know, the age, your experience, you know, you get your own layer. And I think that's interesting about cinema. It's just like the audience complete the film.
That's Pablo Bearhair, director of the animated feature Robot Dreams, out in theaters now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Aisha. It was a pleasure to talk with you about Robot Dreams.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from Organic Valley, a farmer-owned cooperative dedicated to providing ethically sourced food from small organic family farms across the country. Learn more at ov.coop/ethically sourced. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing a transformative approach to justice that is community-led, restorative, and racially just. Learn more at publicwelfare.org. And the listeners of KQED. We go to Mel Baker now for the latest about traffic as a result of the Corral fire and other things around the Bay Area.
580 westbound through the Altamont Pass, eastbound, I should say, through the Altamont Pass is closed at the 205 interchange due to the Corral fire. They're hoping to have that cleared by 11 a.m. You can still take 205 westbound into the Central Valley. Now, eastbound. Now on the Bay Bridge, confusion here as well. We have a back